Having said this, Beelzebub became thoughtful, and after a long pause said, "The theme of our present talk reminds me of a certain interesting conversation I had during my sojourn in France with a young and most congenial three-brained being. I think perhaps it will be best for your understanding of everything that has just been said if I repeat that conversation to you in full, the more so as besides explaining the meaning of the custom of abdast or ablution, it will enlighten you on many other questions relating to the peculiar psyche of these favorites of yours. The being with whom I had this conversation was that young Persian who, you remember, at the request of our mutual acquaintances, was my guide in the city of Paris, where I happened to be just before my departure for the continent of America. One day, I was waiting for this young Persian on the terrace of the famous Grand Café in the city of Paris. As soon as he arrived, I saw from his eyes that he was, as they say there, more drunk than usual. In general, he drank more than his share of the alcoholic beverages existing there. And when we were together in the restaurants in Montmartre, where it was obligatory to order champagne, which I neither liked nor drank, he always drank it all himself with great pleasure. Besides drinking too much, he was also, as he said there, a great skirt chaser. The moment he saw the pretty face of a being of the female sex, his whole body and even his breathing abruptly changed. I noticed that this time he was more drunk than usual, and after he had sat down beside me and ordered coffee with an aperitif, I asked him, 'Please explain to me, my young friend, why do you always drink this poison?' To this question of mine, he answered, 'Eh, my dear doctor, I drink this poison in the first place because I am so used to it that I cannot stop drinking without suffering. And in the second place, because only thanks to the effect of the alcohol can I look on calmly at the obscenity going on here.' And he waved his hand around. I started drinking this poison, as you called it, because accidental circumstances, most unlucky for me, forced me to come and live for a long time in this maleficent Europe. I began to drink because everybody I met drank, and unless you drink, you are called a weak sister, goody-goody, sissy, milquetoast, and similar derisive names. Not wishing my business acquaintances to call me by these offensive names, I also began to drink. Furthermore, when I came to Europe for the first time, I became aware that conditions of life here, in respect of morality and patriarchality, contrasted strongly with those in which I was born and brought up. And seeing and perceiving all this, I used to have a sickening feeling of shame and an unaccountable embarrassment. On the other hand, I noticed that alcohol not only relieved my distress, but allowed me to look at everything quite calmly and even wish to participate in this abnormal life, so contradictory to my nature and established views. And that is why every time I feel this unpleasant sensation, I begin to drink, even with some feeling of self-justification. And little by little, I have become accustomed to this poison, as you have quite justly called it." Having said this with a perceptible impulse of heartfelt grief, he paused a moment to light his cigarette, made of a mixture of tobacco and tambak. Taking this opportunity, I asked him, "Well and good, assuming that I have more or less understood your explanation of your inexcusable drunkenness and can put myself in your shoes, what about your other vice? From my point of view, just as inexcusable, that is, your drooling after petticoats. Why, you run after every skirt as long as it is around the hips of someone with long hair." At this question of mine, he sighed deeply and then replied, It seems to me that I got this habit partly for the reason I already mentioned. But I think this weakness has still another interesting psychological explanation. If you like, my dear doctor, I will tell you in detail how I understand it myself. Of course, I expressed my desire to hear him, but suggested our first going inside the Grand Café, into the restaurant itself, as it was already getting damp out of doors. When we were seated in the restaurant and had ordered a bottle of their famous champagne, he continued as follows. When you were living in Persia, my dear doctor, perhaps you happened to observe the very definite attitude our Persian men have toward women. Among us in Persia, men have two quite distinct organic attitudes toward women, according to which we unconsciously divide women into two categories. The first attitude is the one we have toward the woman as the present or future mother, and the second, the one we have toward the woman female, as one might say. This characteristic of our Persian men of having data in their nature for these two distinct organic attitudes began to be formed in them only recently, about 2.5 centuries ago. According to the explanations once given to me by my uncle, a mullah, whom everyone called behind his back a mullah of the old school, it seems that 2 or 3 centuries ago, for reasons evidently ensuing from certain higher world laws, people began making war on each other more intensively than usual everywhere on the earth, especially among us in Asia, while at the same time, in most of the men, the feeling of piety very definitely diminished and in some of them entirely disappeared. Just at that period, a certain form of psychic disease spread among the men, and many of those afflicted with it either became quite insane or committed suicide. Then certain wise people of different independent groups on the continent of Asia, with the help of various representatives of medicine, which, by the way, was at that time on a much higher level than contemporary medicine, began very earnestly to search for the causes of this new human misfortune. After long and impartial labors, they discovered, on the one hand, that the men who contracted this disease were exclusively those in whose subconscious, for some reason or other, there no longer arose any impulse of faith in anyone or anything. And on the other hand, that those adult men who periodically performed the normal ritual of intercourse with women were immune to this disease. When the news of this conclusion of theirs spread over the continent of Asia, the rulers and chiefs of the separate Asiatic groups of that time grew alarmed, as almost all the regular troops at their disposal consisted of adult men, and moreover, the constant wars did not permit them to live normally with their families. Since at that period, all those governing the different Asiatic countries recognized their need for healthy and strong armies, they were obliged to conclude a truce, and either to go in person or send their representatives to the capital of what was then called the Khanate of Kilmantoosh, in order jointly to find a way out of the situation that had arisen. After serious reflections and deliberations, these rulers of the various independent groups of Asiatic peoples, or their delegates, of course in collaboration with the representatives of medicine of that time, came to the conclusion that the only way to deal with the situation that had arisen would be through the establishment of what is called prostitution everywhere on the continent of Asia, as it now exists on the continent of Europe, and that this would succeed only if the power-possessing people deliberately cooperated in its development. Almost all the chiefs of state of that time fully agreed with this conclusion of the representatives of the peoples of the continent of Asia, assembled in the capital of the Khanate of Tilmantush, and from then on, without experiencing any remorse of conscience, they not only began to encourage and aid all women in general, with the exception of their own daughters, to engage in this occupation so abhorrent and repulsive to the nature of every normal person, but also gave generous assistance to all those women of whatever caste or religion who wished to go anywhere for this dirty purpose. They even did this with a feeling of benevolence, as if it were the most considerate and humane manifestation. Now that we have touched upon this subject, allow me, respected doctor, to digress slightly and tell you about the wise and interesting reflections of my mullah uncle on the causes of this scourge of contemporary civilization. Once during Ramadan, when we were conversing as usual while awaiting the call of the mullah of our district that would announce the meal hour, we happened to be speaking about this human scourge, and my uncle said, among other things, "It is wrong and unjust of you to blame and despise all women of this kind. Most of them are not personally responsible for their sad lot. The real culprits are their parents, husbands, and guardians. And indeed, the only ones to be blamed and despised are their parents or guardians, who, while these children were at the age of preparation for adulthood and did not as yet have their own common sense, allowed the arising in them of the property called laziness. Although at that age, this laziness is still only automatic in them, and young people do not have to make great efforts to overcome it, so that on acquiring their own common sense, they can prevent it from gaining complete control over them. Nevertheless, the organization of women's psyche is such that owing to results not depending on our will, but ensuing from world laws, the active principle must unfailingly participate in every initiative and in every good manifestation of theirs. It is thanks to the various ideas concerning rights of women that are current throughout the contemporary world under the catchwords of equal rights, equal opportunities, women's suffrage, and so on, ideas which are naive to the understanding of a man who has lived his life normally, but which are unconsciously accepted by the majority of men today, that these unfortunate, not yet completely formed, prospective women mothers, on the one hand, not having near them during the early years of their adult life the law-conformable requisite sources of the active principle which their parents or guardians should represent, and later their husbands, to whom the responsibility for them passes from the moment of marriage, and on the other hand, undergoing the intense process of imagination and enthusiasm proper to that transitional age and lawfully foreordained by nature to help provide data for developing their common sense, gradually absorb this automatic laziness into their very nature, where it remains as an increasingly irresistible need. A woman with such a nature obviously does not wish to fulfill the obligations of a genuine woman mother. And since being a prostitute enables her to do nothing and even to experience great pleasure, there is gradually formed, both in her nature and in the passive consciousness proper to her, an irresistible tendency to become a woman female. But as the data proper to all women for the impulse of shame are not atrophied all at once in the instinct of these women females, and as not one of them, in spite of all her mental wishing, can bear to become a prostitute in her own native country, each of them tries, instinctively or half-consciously, to get away to some other country, where, far from her native land, without any inner discomfort, she can abandon herself entirely to this profession, personally pleasant for her in almost every respect. And as for the prevalence of this human misfortune everywhere on the earth today, this is due, in my opinion, exclusively to those contemporary men in whom, for the same reasons as in those young women, future prostitutes, there arises a similar, essential organic need to do nothing but enjoy oneself. And one of the ways in which this scum of contemporary society satisfies that criminal need is by enticing and helping such women to leave their native land for some foreign country.